Now, in chapter 34, he starts talking once again about Edom, about Turkey, and not just them, but using them primarily as an example of what he's going to do to the nations that treat Judah and Israel so terribly. So he starts off talking about all the nations. Come near, you nations, to hear, and hearken, you peoples, should be plural there in the Hebrew again, talking about the multitude of nationalities and languages that make up the mass that's gathered there. So they're coming near. Let the earth hear, and all that's therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. And here the word world in Hebrew is the word for inhabited world. So it's worldwide, a worldwide message in verse 1. Apparently, when God gathers all these nations at Armageddon, all the nations and peoples from all the inhabited earth are going to be there to hear. For the indignation of the eternal is upon all nations. His fury is upon all their armies. So when Christ comes back at Armageddon, all of the nations from the rest of the inhabited earth are gathered there, whether they're Asiatics or whether they're Europeans. And his indignation is upon all nations, all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. And that's not very well translated. It literally comes from the terms devoted to destruction, or placed under a divine ban, doomed to destruction. In other words, it's already recorded. It's already written in the Bible what their fate has to be. So it's already decided and determined. They've been devoted to destruction. They've been placed under a ban of destruction. So that's more the Hebrew terminology. They've been devoted to the slaughter. Their slain are going to be cast out. In other words, not even time for them to be buried. There are going to be so many of them. The blood all the way up to the horses' bridles, and all the fighters on the rest of the earth put to death. Their slain won't be buried in the tomb. They'll be cast out. Their stench shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. In other words, the blood is going to go up the mountainsides enough that mountains are not as tall. They don't appear as tall because of the blood shed. They're in the valley out of Megiddo going into Jerusalem. And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heaven shall be rolled together as a scroll. And some of those are taken very plainly into Revelation as some of the seals, as some of the descriptions Christ used leading up to the end time. The heavens will depart like a scroll. All the hosts of heaven dissolve. In other words, the stars of heaven falling, and the sun turned to darkness, and the moon into blood. So here's the same thing being described at the time Christ intervenes with the nations along with Turkey. All the hosts of heaven dissolve. The heavens roll together as a scroll. All their hosts fall down as the leaf fades off from the vine, as a fading of the leaf of a fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. In other words, it's going to be full of blood. It's going to be drunk, as the word bathed is translated other places. Behold, it'll come down upon Edomia and upon the people of my curse. In other words, nations that have been already prophesied, that are doomed to taste of God's wrath, and he comes and intervenes. The people of my band, same word as up above, they've already been consigned to this judgment because they're not going to repent, or they're not going to heed. The sword of the eternal is filled with blood. It's made fat with fatness, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the eternal has a sacrifice in Bozrah, of course, the capital at the time, and a great slaughter in the land of Edomia. So here he's likening some of the animals of sacrifice to these peoples that are going to be sacrificed because of insisting on warring when Christ comes back to put a halt to war and intervene. And the unicorn shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls. So some think in verse 6 he's talking about more of the average, common, normal, run-of-the-mill people, likened to lambs and goats and rams. And then the big shots, the real top-notch leaders, are going to come down with them. They're not going to be left. the leaders especially are going to be the ones brought down. So he likens them to a rhinoceros or bullock or bulls. So they're going to come down at the same time. Their land will be soaked with blood, their dust made fat with fatness. And now he describes in verse 8, it is the day of the eternal's vengeance. Now, of course, any time in Hebrew you have a term, the day of the Lord, or the day of this, or the day of salvation, it can mean an indefinite time period. It might mean 100 years, 1,000 years, it might mean 3 lifetimes. But you know, if you ever have an adjective in front of it, the first day, then it has to be 24 hours. You won't ever find any exceptions to that. So the days of creation weren't 7,000 years, as Jehovah's Witnesses say. They weren't eons or ages of time, because it said the evening and the morning were the first day. So that shows it had to be a 24-hour period. But notice here how he double talks. It's the day of the eternal's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. So as Mr. Armstrong says, the ultimate final day of the Lord is going to be a year. And this is a good verse to back that up. The day of the eternal's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. In other words, for people that had a part in bringing down God's people. So he couldn't have said that if he's right in among all of them. Well, anyway, a few more evidences to show the distinction between the lost 10 tribes and the remnant that was left, the few stragglers of the house of Judah. And he calls them that here a little later. Just plain, strictly, the house of Judah. Now, there were very few that came down out of the northern areas, not even enough to list in the genealogies in Ezra and Nehemiah. So don't let anybody hoodwink you there. Well, anyway, going on, this is the word which the Eternal has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you and laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head at you. So apparently God's church, as well as some of the end time people of Israel, or Judah, are going to laugh at this beast leader, going to make light of him and disregard him and despise him. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? Against whom have you exalted your voice and lifted up your eyes on high? Against the Holy One of Israel. Not just against a little country and a bunch of people. Not just against the King Hezekiah and some leaders. You've done that against the Holy One of Israel. By your servants, you've reproached the Eternal, or the Lord rather, and you've said, quote, by the multitude of my chariot, I'm come up to the height of the mountains. Well, I've just devoured the biggest of empires, and it's all by the multitude of my chariots, by my own abilities, to the sides of Lebanon. I'll cut down the tall cedars thereof, and the choice fir trees thereof. So there again, likening the cedars of Lebanon to the chief leaders of the nations. I'll enter into the height of his border, and the forest of his Carmel. I've digged and drunk water, and with the sole of my feet I've dried up all the rivers of the besieged places. So they just tore out all of the waterways and all of the water canals and the wells and everything after they served themselves with them, digged and drunk water, and then destroyed them. Have you not heard long ago how I've done it, and of ancient times that I've formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that you should be to lay waste defense cities into ruinous heaps. Therefore their inhabitants were of small power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field, and as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops, as corn blasted before it be grown up. In other words, devoured by excess heat and no moisture. But I know your abode, and you're going out, and you're coming in, and your rage against me. So now God is talking to the false prophet or the beast, this great leader of Assyria, and says, I know your abode and you're going out and you're coming in, your rage against me, because your rage against me and your tumults come up into your, in mine ears. Therefore, I'll put my hook in your nose. So just like you led people around on chains or ropes and took them, deported them into other countries, God says, that's what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I'm going to turn you back by the way by which you came. And this is going to be a sign to you. You're going to eat this year such as grows of itself, and the second year that which springs of the same. In other words, they're not even allowed to plant. They're so busy with wars and devastations and troubles and curses and problems. So they just have to eat what grows of itself, and even for a second year what springs of the same. And then finally in the third year, they'd be able to sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof. And the remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah. So there aren't any remnant that are escaped of the house of Israel. Not in this group there aren't. Oh, there may be a few from some of the tribes of the northern ten that fled down into Judea, but they were swallowed up into the nation of Judea. And they didn't maintain a separate house of Israel. So when God likens a remnant that's escaped, he talks about a remnant of the house of Judah. And they're going to again take root downward and bear fruit upward. Because out of Jerusalem is going to go forth a remnant, and they that escape are going to go out of Mount Zion. The zeal of the Eternal Host is going to do that. Therefore, thus says the Eternal concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shields, nor cast a bank against it. And he gives a very good description there of how the Assyrians took over a fortified city. By the way that he came, by the same he'll return. And he'll not come into this city, says the Eternal. And I will shield this city. This is probably a better translation. To save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. So over and over again in prophecy, you find God reminding and remembering about the covenant of David. So another reason God couldn't allow the Jews to be taken away and devastated and transplanted and left without coming back to their country, for my servant David's sake. Well, then the angel of the Eternal went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And then when Israel rose early in the morning, behold, everybody around that was left was dead. Now, you know, when anybody wants me to join an army like that, I'm ready to go to an army and fight. So I've got a big CO across that verse, and somebody tries to draft me later, I'm going to say, well, say, you got an angel of God that can slay 185,000? Then I'm ready to sign up, but don't expect me to kill anybody, because I'm not going to do it. And, you know, that always happened. When they had total trust in God, God always did all the fighting. You know, how many Egyptians did the Israelites kill as they fled through the Red Sea? Not a one. God took care of them. Well, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. So he never did come back there, just like God said he wouldn't. He was so busy fighting and maintaining what he had before that he didn't have time to spread out any further. He was having trouble with Babylon and the rulers around. Well, it came to pass, he's worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god. Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, smote him with a sword. And they escaped into the land of Armenia, Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. So here God foretold exactly what would happen. Now, he foretold several decades earlier that the Assyrians were going to come down to Judea, but they weren't going to take it. And here he even told exactly how he would stop this current ruler from entering into the city. Now, Hezekiah's sickness took place during this time that the Assyrians were sieging, as you'll see as you read here, in those days, not after they went away and left them alone. And maybe a lot of the worry and the fear and the waiting on God, and maybe that's partly what caused Hezekiah's sickness, but you'll see a little more of what caused it as you read along here too. In those days, Hezekiah was sick unto death. Well, Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, thus says the Eternal, set your house in order, because you're going to die and not live. So he made it doubly emphatic. You know, it'd been enough to say you're going to die, but say you're going to die and you're not going to live. You know, that's
shuts the front door and the back door. Well, Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed unto the Eternal. Now, Hezekiah was typical human. Sometimes when he got into trouble, he didn't pray. And other times when he got into trouble, he did pray. And every time he prayed, came out great. And every time he didn't, you know, he'd learn the hard way, as you're going to see here. But Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed unto the Eternal. And you know what's always amazing to me? People who've had the most striking miracles work in their lives, you'd think they'd be the strongest Christians forever from then on. That isn't true at all. I think the two outstanding miracles, well, there are several of them I've known about. I know one man in Iowa that had a big iron melting, smelting place, and they dropped that hot metal, and it just ran all over him and didn't even, you know, just like he had an angel all around him, protected him. And I remember a lady up in Chicago I anointed one time was going blind with cataracts, and she got up a few mornings later to wash her face and splashing her face with water out of the basin and looked in the mirror and saw these little specks in the corners of eyes and thought, well, what is that anyway? And just picked those cataracts and just dropped them right in the trash. She not in the church. You know, the quadriplegics I've known of who were healed, thankfully one died in the church in Tulsa and another one's out of the church. So seemingly people that have the greatest miracles work, you'd surely think Hezekiah, having had 15 years added to his life, boy, he'd be a spiritual dynamo from then on, wouldn't he? Well, that might be what you think, but let's just wait and see. So notice what Hezekiah did. He said, remember now, O Eternal, I beseech you, how I have walked before you in truth and with a perfect heart, and I've done good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept with great weeping. Now, you know, that's all right to do. When you get in a real bind and you're human and you're afraid and you think God isn't going to hear you, and you say, well, now, God, remember the jobs I gave up for the Sabbath, and remember the persecution I had because of no Christmas and Easter, and God, think about all these years. And I mean, I'm not throwing this up into your face, but what's the matter, God? What's the matter with me, or what's happening now? And, you know, that's what he did. Why, I've walked before you in truth and with a mature heart, and I've done good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept sore. Then the word of the Eternal came to Isaiah, saying, go and say to Hezekiah. And you know, if you read this back in the account in Kings, it shows that Isaiah didn't even get out of the castle. Didn't even get back home. He just got through telling him, you're going to live and not die. And then a little bit later, God says, say, you got to go back and tell him he is going to live, not going to die. Now, you know, if a man's worried about his credibility with the people, he might say, now, wait a minute, God already told him he's going to die and not live. Now I'm going back there and telling him he's going to live, not die. So apparently that kind of got Jonah upset. But notice Hezekiah, say to Hezekiah, thus says the Eternal God of David your father. I wonder why he'd say David your father. Well, God always had that promise to David. And as long as you can remember how faithful God is in his promise to David, then why wouldn't he be faithful in the promise to you? Why, remember your father David, Hezekiah. The God of your father David says, I've heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Now, people can think they can just cry their eyes out over tribulation and trouble and hardship and God not even know it. That isn't true at all. You know, I could take the time and show you one scripture where God says he measures your tears in his bottle. So for people to think God is so callous and so distant, he doesn't even pay any attention to people's tears, that's just not true at all. You know, God says not a hair of your head falls but what he knows about it, from worry or trouble or tribulation. Now, this is one of the golden chapters in the Bible. I have seen your tears. I have heard your prayer. Behold, I'll add to your days 15 years. And I'm going to deliver you in this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria. And I'm going to defend this city. So God not only answered the prayer of what he requested, but he's even giving him what he didn't request. I'm going to defend this city or shield it, and this is going to be a sign to you from the Eternal that the Eternal will do this thing that He's spoken. Well, I'm going to bring again the shadow of the degrees, which has gone down in the sundial of Ahaz, 10 degrees backward, so the sun returned 10 degrees, by which degrees it was gone down. Now, you know, people want to criticize the Bible and say it's not scientific because it talks about the going down of the sun, and yet God wrote the Bible for man on earth. And as far as man on earth knows, the sun does go down. I mean, I look out and see it dropping off into the Pacific, it's going down. Now, to me, I'm not going around, it's just standing there, it's going down. So God wrote the Bible for man on the earth. He didn't write the Bible for man out where God is. Now, you might think, well, what if He'd written it for this world, in our day? Then what about all those people before they knew the earth was round and the earth turned and the sun didn't go down? Then you'd have had half a man's life back then. They'd have been dumbfounded and ignorant. They couldn't have believed the Bible. So God intervened and worked a miracle here. The writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and was recovered of his sickness. And really the word writing there is not the accurate word. It's the same Hebrew word that you find in the beginning of a lot of the Psalms. You may notice in a lot of the Psalms, miktam, M-I-C-H-T-A-M. Well, this is the same word. It's got a different ending, miktab, M-I-C-H-T-A-B. But these are in the subscriptions of a lot of the Psalms, and that's what he wrote here. It's kind of a psalm hymn. The writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he'd been sick and was recovered of his sickness. I said, in the cutting off of my days, I shall go to the gates of the grave, another word for Sheol, or another place for hell. I'm deprived of the residue of my years. So here's his sad ode to death when his life was being cut off prematurely. I said, I'll not see the Eternal. Now that's kind of a poor translation too, because the Hebrew term there, see, is appear before. So he's talking about holy days again. I'm not going to get to appear before the Eternal anymore. Goes back to the laws of Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the holy days. I'm not going to get to go before the Eternal in the land of the living. I shall behold man no more with the inhabitants of the world. Mine age is departed and is removed from me as a shepherd's tent. I've cut off like a weaver my life. Now, there's like a weaver cuts his string. That's how his life was just that close to being cut off. He'll cut me off with pining sickness from day to night. Will you make an end of me? I reckon till morning. In other words, I waited expectantly till morning, like a lion waiting on its prey. So will he break all my bones. In other words, just no strength in your bones, just limp. Your bones don't do any good. So close to death and weak and discouraged. From day to night, will you make an end of me? Like a crane or a swallow, the twittering of birds, I chattered and mourned as a dove. Mine eyes fail with looking upward. O Eternal, I'm oppressed. Undertake for me. Be a surety for me. What'll I say? He's spoken to me, and himself has done it. I'll go softly or slowly. I'm going to enjoy the rest of these years. I'm not going to be in such a big hurry anymore. I'm going to go slowly, as the Hebrew word literally means here. All my years and the bitterness of my soul. O Eternal, by these things men live, and in all these things is the life of my spirit, so will you recover me and make me to live. Behold, for peace I had great bitterness, but you have in love to my soul delivered it from the pit of corruption. And it's the pit or corruption there, not a pit of corruption. For you've cast all my sins behind your back. And that's kind of an interesting statement, because the opposite of this is where your sins are ever before him, remember? Your sins are always before his face. You might notice that in Psalm 109. Of course, you remember it in Psalm 51. Verse 14. Let the iniquity, and here he's talking about the seed of evildoers, Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered with the eternal, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the eternal continually, that he may cut off the memory of them from the earth. So, as David said in Psalm 51, my sin is ever before men. He said, hide your face from my sins. And so here, Hezekiah, when God is going to forgive him, talks about casting all my sins behind your back. Not keeping them between us anymore, or not having them in front of us, looking at them anymore. For the grave can't praise you, death can't celebrate you, they that go down into the pit can't hope for your truth. The living, he'll praise you, as I do this day. The father to the children shall make known your truth. The eternal is ready to save me. And you know what most people don't realize too, up to this time, he didn't have any children. He didn't have an heir. And he wasn't even married to have children to replace him. And yet here he talks about the father to the children making known your truth. And during this added 15 years, he had a son. The eternal was ready to save me. Therefore, we'll sing my songs. Now, what songs is he talking about there? Well, he's probably talking about some of those songs of degrees. We will sing my songs to the stringed instruments. So maybe there is a connection between the sundial being turned back 10 degrees, and I never counted whether 10 of those psalms are untitled as far as who wrote them. I know David wrote some of them, but notice Psalm 120. The very first one is Song of Degrees. So almost as if he's remembering those years God added to his life, as if God added 15 degrees to his life, but as a sign, God caused the sundial to go back 10 degrees, but he apparently put together these groups of psalms into songs of degrees. They're also called songs of ascent, which meant as they ascended up the 15 steps going up to the temple, they sang each one of these. And if you notice the context, they are festive-type psalms. In my distress, I cried unto the Eternal, and he heard me. Deliver my soul, O Eternal, from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. So here's the battle everybody has all year long until it comes time for the holy days. And on that first step of the temple, you look back and remember all the distress and difficulty you've had during the past year. What'll he give to you? What'll he be done to you, you false tongue? Then in 121, you know, that's not a song of David. I'll lift up mine eyes to the hills from whence comes my help. My help comes from the Creator, the Eternal. He won't suffer your foot to be removed. He doesn't have to sleep. He's your keeper. Verse 8, the Eternal shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth. Then we read part of 122 and 123, another one of these degrees. Unto you I lift up mine eyes, O you that dwell in the heavens. Behold, is the eyes of servants to the hand of their masters. But you know, as you read through some of these, it brings back the trial that Hezekiah had with the Assyrians and also with his threat of death and then having 15 years added to his life. Well, we better stay out of the Psalms there whenever we'll get through Isaiah. Anyway, back to Isaiah again. The Eternal is ready to save me. Therefore, we'll sing my songs to the stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Eternal. Now, the only time you do that is either on the Sabbath or on holy days. So he has to be talking about the occasions of going into God's house. For Isaiah had said, let them take a lump of figs, lay it for a plaster upon the boil, and he'll recover. Hezekiah also said, what's the sign that I'll go up to the house of the Eternal? Of course, he had the sundial go backward, and then he added the 15 years. Now, with the historical backsetting there, bringing us up to date, then you start out in Isaiah 39. At that time,
shortly after these miracles of the sundial and Hezekiah's recovery, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah because he'd heard that he'd been sick and was recovered. And, of course, here he's going to pull something that armies didn't get away with, but now by trickery, by the Judas kiss, the person's going to be able to do what another wasn't able to do. So he sent letters and a present. And Hezekiah was glad of them. He showed them the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ointment and all the house of his armor and all that was found in his treasures. Notice anything in there? That isn't the same guy that was doing all that praying in chapter 38, you know. And that's just like we are, you know. We give rainy day prayers, and when the enemy's right there ready to take you over, boy, you can really get fervent. And then the enemy turns tail and runs, and you're safe, and then you say, well, boy, thanks God. And you know, it's like the little boy falling off the roof and praying and asking God to help him as he was rolling down this tin roof, falling off, you know. And he got to the bottom of it, and his suspenders hanged on a nail there, and he said, all right, God, I don't need you now. And that's kind of like we are, isn't it? No wonder God has to let us have troubles. We wouldn't, you know, it's why Paul said, God's strength is made perfect in weakness. Because when you're weak, that's when you're strong. And Paul said, wherefore I glory in my infirmities. Well, here's the same Hezekiah. Gullible? Talk about naive. Could you say dumb? Boy, this is ridiculous to say the least. He just got rid of one enemy. Apparently he thought, boy, look what God's able to do. I don't have any worries anymore. Don't need any wisdom. Don't need any prevention. Don't need any caution or concern or care. Boy, you can just be dumb and God will take care of you anyway. Well, I can't figure this out. Can you imagine, why would God have these two chapters back to back? So much a contrast. So here, a king of Babylon, just because he's sick and recovered and gets letters in the present, and because he's glad of them, so he showed him the house of his precious things. They're not his. They belong to God. They belong to Judah. They belong to the people. They belong to the country. They belong to God. The silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ointment and all the house of his armor and all that was found in his treasures, there was nothing in his house nor in all his dominion that Hezekiah didn't show them. Then came Isaiah the prophet to King Hezekiah, and he said to him, what said these men? And where'd they come from to you? Well, Hezekiah said, well, they're coming from a far country to me, from Babylon. Then he said, well, what have they seen in your house? Old open. Hezekiah said, well, all that's in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I haven't shown them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Eternal Host. Behold, the day has come that all that's in your house, that which your fathers have laid up in store until this day, it's not yours. Your fathers laid it up. It's going to be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Eternal. And of your sons, and yet here he's telling him this, and he hadn't even had any sons. Wasn't even married. And not only is he prophesying that he's going to get married and have sons, and of your sons that shall issue from you. So in the third year of these 15 years God added, he had a son. And then he had other sons after that. And you might notice back in Psalm 127, we get back there again, so many of these parallels are there that it's almost a cinch he wrote a group of these songs of degrees. Psalm 127, except the Eternal build a house, they labor in vain to build it. Except the Eternal keep the city, the watchman wakes but in vain.
This one's ascribed to Solomon. It's vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. So he gives his beloved sleep. Lo, children are a gift of the Eternal, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of your youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full on them. Yet here he didn't even have any sons yet. Now God tells him he's going to have sons in Psalm 128. Blessed is everyone that fears the Eternal, that walks in his ways. You'll eat the labor of your hands. You'll be happy and it'll be well with you. Your wife will be as a fruitful vine by the sides of your house. Your children like olive plants round about your table. Behold, that thus shall the man be blessed that fears the Eternal. The Eternal shall bless you out of Zion. You'll see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Yet you'll see your children's children and peace on Israel. And these are quoted here again in Isaiah 39. Well, let's come back to Isaiah 39 and pick up again where we left off. Of your sons that will issue from you, which you shall beget, they shall take away. They shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And sure enough, if you remember Daniel 1, verses 3 and 4, the chief of these royal seed of Judah, they took and made eunuchs in the house of the kings of Babylon, just like God said here would happen. Now, verse 8, then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, good is the word of the Eternal which you've spoken. Well, I should have learned. I should have been so simple. I should have known better than that. But at least you're telling me some good, that I'm going to get married and have sons, and I'll just have to enjoy them, and then when God's will comes to pass, well, good is the word of the Eternal which you've spoken. He said, moreover, for there shall be peace and truth in my days. So at least I'm going to have some time of marriage and children and peace, and then if that's God's will, well, whatever God says. Well, that's sad to see that happen to man that quickly, the contrast between the two chapters. Now in Isaiah 40, comfort you my people, says your God. Speak you comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry to her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. So this is likened to what we read back before these history chapters were inserted. Then it picks up back there with that chapter again, starts talking about making strong the feeble knees and strengthening the faint hearts and comforting the people and saying God's time of intervention and punishment's about over, and you've about paid the penalty for your sin, and your iniquity is pardoned. For she has received of the Eternal's hand double for all her sins. And it means they've just been fully paid, thoroughly paid. There are many other places where that terminology is used, and it doesn't mean exactly double for each thing at all. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare you the way of the Eternal. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted. So apparently some places on earth are just too low to be worth anything. And a lot of the wastelands and desert lands, the trouble with them is that they're just too low. So all those extremely low areas that are waste are going to be lifted up. And a lot of the mountains that are just worthless, there's no purpose to them, are going to be made low. And the crooked is going to be made straight, and the rough places plain. So I guess the Pasadena Freeway will just be a straight shot instead of all those crooks there. Well, that's the oldest freeway in the world, and it must have been designed by a drunk, the way it wanders around. But maybe we ought to make a sign and put it down there at the entrance of the freeway, off the scripture here, that the crooked will be made straight. The voice of him who cries in the wilderness, prepare you the way of the Eternal, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley will be exalted, and every mountain and hill made low, the crooked made straight, and the glory of the Eternal shall be revealed. So all the nations on earth are going to come to know the real true God and the glory of the true God.
All flesh is going to see it together. In other words, he's going to come like lightning from the east and the west, and everybody's going to know he's here. He's not going to sneak back to anybody individually. For the mouth of the Eternal has spoken it. That's the way it's going to be. The voice said, cry. And he said, what'll I cry? Well, cry that all flesh is grass. Temporary. Just depending on water and nourishment to continue to exist, all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. Grass withers, flower fades, because the Spirit of the Eternal blows upon it, or the winds that God allows to dry out things. Surely the people is grass. So now he's likening people to grass in the sense of temporariness. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the Word of our God isn't like grass. It stands forever. Oh, Zion, that brings good tidings. So now Zion is going to be the center of the truth going out to all the world. And all those that dwell in Zion are going to be going out from there bringing good tidings. Gospel. Same term in Septuagint Greek of this Hebrew. Get you up into the high mountains. In other words, it's going to be told in Russia and China and Japan and Germany and all of the top, big, powerful countries. O Jerusalem, that bringeth good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up, don't be afraid. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. So, apparently we may be giving that message out between now and the time that Christ comes back and all this takes place. Behold, the Lord Eternal is going to come with strong hand, and his arm's going to rule for him. His reward is with him. And that's quoted many a time in the New Testament. His work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He'll gather the lambs with his arm, carry them in his bosom, gently lead those that are with young. So here's a beautiful picture of the millennium all the way through here. And now he begins to describe God, beginning verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Well, that must have been a big job, balancing out the world that way, creating a wealth and blessing in all countries. Who has directed the Spirit of the Eternal, or being his counselor has taught him? With whom took he counsel? And who made him understand, taught him in the path of judgment, taught him knowledge, showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket. They're counted as the small dust of the balance. So, you know, no matter what countries there are in God's power, it's just like blowing the dust off the scales or off the Bible or off your tables. Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing. Whether that's the British Isles or the Philippine Isles or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. In God's sight, any countries are just like dust, like a drop in a bucket. Lebanon isn't sufficient to burn. If God were a smoker, that'd be a good place to say smoke, wouldn't it? So even all the cedars of Lebanon aren't even sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof. They're not even sufficient for a burnt offering. God's so big and great. All nations before him are nothing. All nations are counted to him less than nothing in vanity. Not that he doesn't regard man or regard potential. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? And then you've got a few verses on idols. The workman melts a graven image. The goldsmith spreads it over with gold and casts silver chains. He who's so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree that won't rot. Seeks to him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that will not be moved. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hadn't it been told you from the beginning? Haven't you understood from the foundations of the earth? He that sits upon the circle of the earth and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretched out the heavens as a curtain and spread them out as a tent to dwell in. There's the great God, not something you make out of wood or metal and then put gold or silver over it. This God brings the princes to nothing. This God makes the judges of the earth as vanity. It doesn't take too much work to do that. They're well on the way to that without too much help, huh? Yea, they'll not be planted. Of course, that means he's going to remove their position, take away their job. It's going to disappear. Yea, they'll not be planted. Yea, they'll not be sown. No more human princes. No more human judges. None of them are ever going to be planted or sown, so they come back up and you have to have them around anymore. Yea, their stock's not going to take root in the earth. He is also going to blow on them, and they're going to wither. The whirlwind's going to take them away like stubble, whether they're princes or judges. Well, then to whom can you liken God? Or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Well, lift up your eyes on high and behold who's created these. What about all the heavens that you look out and see that brings out their host by numbers? He calls them all by names by the greatness of his might. So God did put them in a pattern in the heavens. He gave them a design and a grouping together. For that he is strong in power, not one fails. All the time since creation, they've all stayed up there, and you can see them all the time in their formation, in their time of the year, all called by the names God grouped them together by. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the eternal? Isn't that silly? How can any human feel like he's hidden out from God and God doesn't see all of his doings? And yet look at all the great things God has done, and yet why can humans think God doesn't see them? My judgment is passed over from my God. Have you not known, haven't you heard? The everlasting God, the eternal, the creator of the ends of the earth doesn't faint. He isn't weary. There's no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the faint. And to them who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the eternal, they'll renew their strength. They'll mount up with wings as eagles and run and not be weary, and walk and not faint. This next chapter kind of ties in with that, so maybe we can scan it and hurry. Keep silence before me, O islands. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Let them speak. Let's come near together to judgment. Who raised up Cyrus, the righteous man from the east, and called him to his foot, and gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings? He gave them as the dust of his sword, and as driven stubble to his bow. In other words, that's God's interventions in history. The streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, the dust thereof into brimstone, the land thereof shall become burning pitch. Now, if you want to have a picture of hell, then here's another good verse for hell, just like we had back in verse 14 of the previous chapter. But when you have a Bible picture of hell, you don't have one that burns forever and ever and ever. You have one that has thorns burnt, that has wheat and chaff or straw burnt. You have one that's like brimstone. You have one that, like the fire that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even devoured the ground and left the Dead Sea, the deepest hole on earth. So if you want to know what fire from heaven does, it doesn't just torture you for a billion years, a million years. You know, fire from heaven consumes everything. Dirt, water, everything. Like when they built the altar and poured all the water on the sacrifices back in the days of Elisha. And the fire came down, devoured the animals and the altar and the water and the ditch and the ground underneath it. And that's what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. The deepest spot on earth today is right where fire came down from heaven and burnt and burnt and burnt, but it isn't still burning. And yet God says in Jude that Sodom and Gomorrah set forth an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Well, what is the example of eternal fire? It's not burning forever. And you don't ever get that idea out of the Bible. But God let it be translated enough where Protestants could read that into it. The streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched. Now, not being quenched means it burns itself out. That's all it means. If you said, now I'm going to burn this field and it's not to be quenched. Nobody thinks that field burns 1,000 years. But you know, when you open the Bible, everything doesn't mean what it usually does. Well, that doesn't make sense. God said that this brimstone and burning pitch is not to be quenched. So even that shows it could be quenched, and that shows it could go out, but it's going to burn itself out night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. Now, smoke doesn't go up forever. But that isn't what it means. It means it's going to be burning. There'll be things in it and stuff in it and limestone and all that to be burnt, brimstone. It'll be burning and burning from generation to generation. You know, if he said the smoke will go up forever, why did he have to add from generation to generation? Because that shows what the word forever means. Now, Mr. Armstrong's explained many a time that the word forever in the Hebrew or the Greek by itself doesn't mean endless. But there are other words that do mean endless. Well, how do you know whether the word forever means endless? Well, as he always explained, you have to go to the factors involved. Who are the parties involved? If God said, you do this, and then I'll do this for you forever, then the factors are God and the other party that he agreed to do it with. But if God said the Levites are to wear phylacteries around the borders of their garments forever, and then later said the time would come when there wouldn't be Levites, then forever ended. Now, in our minds, that's hard to believe because we've always thought, well, now, wait a minute now, forever means forever. Well, in the Greek or Hebrew, it just means for ages or for an age to age. So it doesn't mean endlessly. But anyway, here he says from generation to generation, it'll lie waste, none shall pass through it. Now, we know that's been prophesied of Babylon, and here it's prophesied of an area that's referred to as Idumea. So there are going to be several areas at the beginning of the millennium that are going to be Gehennas. They're going to be hells, places for burning. You know, an interesting thing when you study about hell in the New Testament, you know how many men in the whole New Testament referred to hell? I think there are three people, three writers. You know, James never did tell anybody about hell. You know, the Apostle Paul never did tell anybody about hell. You know, how can you believe that? If hell's one of the basic doctrines of Christianity, well, in the first place, anybody that was preaching outside of Judea wouldn't have any knowledge at all about hell, because what do they know about a valley of the sons of Hinnom? That would be like telling somebody in New York or Florida about some 2-acre plot out here somewhere in California, and they never heard of any such place. So only people that were acquainted with Judea understood about Gehenna, the valley of the sons of Hinnom, and most of the writers in the New Testament didn't even use the word. Well, going on anyway, but the cormorant and the bittern shall possess this territory. So it's not the total land burning, but it's a place that's so desolate that people aren't going to dwell there for a while. It's going to be a desolation for wild animals. And most of these birds are just birds of prey that would dwell out in the wilderness, out in a desert-type area. The owl, the raven, he'll stretch out upon it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. And interestingly enough, this is one of three places in the Old Testament where you find the two terms tohu and bohu. You've heard Mr. Armstrong talk about Genesis 1 and verse 2. The earth became waste and confused, tohu and bohu. Well, these are the same two words here. They're used again in Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 23. Waste and confused or empty. They'll call the nobles thereof to the kingdom. Now that's very poorly translated. The Revised Standard Version does a lot better job on verse 12. What it's saying is, as for her nobles, none there, there are none there to proclaim the kingdom. In other words, all their nobles are gone, so there's not even any leadership there to go around talking about the new kingdom of Idumea, or a kingdom of Turkey. The nobles aren't even going to proclaim a kingdom. None of them are going to be there. They're all gone. Thorns are going to grow up in vines as in windows and through walls and desolate houses and palaces. Nettles and brambles will take over. What used to be a fortress, what used to be a habitation, is going to end up being a place of jackals and howlers and a court for owls. the wild beasts of the desert are going to meet with the wild beasts of the island. The satyr will cry to his fellow. The screech owl also is going to rest there and find for herself a place of rest. So it's just a picture of utter desolation and wilderness. There the great owl is going to make her nest and lay and hatch and gather under her shadow. There the vultures are going to be gathered, every one with her mate. Seek you out of the book of the eternal and read. So it's obvious from that statement that a part of God's word had to be in existence on written record. Otherwise, how could people be told to seek you out of the book of the eternal and read? Where would you go in what Bible would have been previously recorded to find what's being prophesied here? Well, that's one thing we've been trying to do from time to time, is show how many references in Isaiah go right back to the first five books of the Bible. So many of the judgments that are pronounced on Israel are ones you've read back in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. And so when he's saying here, just go back and look in Moses' books. Go back and look in the Pentateuch and see. You'll find those first five books. Tell you all these things are going to come when God's people forsook him and disobeyed his laws. Seek you out of the book of the eternal and read. Not a one of the things God prophesied that would happen to sinners, to Israel going astray, would fail. And now he's talking maybe more exactly even about these wildernesses, areas that used to be strong nations turned into wildernesses. Not a one of these animals that's going to be occupying these former prosperous, powerful nations will lack a mate. God has said they'll all come there, and they'll all come there. For my mouth, it has commanded, and his spirit, it has gathered them. So just like God's spirit gathered the animals into the ark in Noah's time, God has prophesied that all these animals are going to inhabit areas of Babylon and Idumea, and so God's mouth has commanded, and God's spirit is going to gather these bitterns and all of these jackals and owls and all those animals. They're going to go right there, just like God gathered them all into the ark in Noah's day. God has cast a lot for all these animals, and God's hand has divided it into them by line. They're going to possess it forever from generation to generation. So there again, he shows you the word forever by itself. You know, if the word forever by itself means endlessly, then you never could say forever and forever. You know, you can't have but one forever if it means endlessly. You know, it'd be like saying, for the eternities of the eternities. Now that, you can't say that. But over and over God says, forever, from generation to generation. All of these animals God's going to gather to these lands that are going to be desolated, and they're going to dwell there. Now in chapter 35, the wilderness and the solitary places shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as a rose. It'll blossom abundantly. Now, of course, the Jews always quote these scriptures. If you were to go to visit Palestine today, the Jewish guides take great delight in showing you they've caused that to happen. Those 250-mile irrigation troughs from the Sea of Galilee, carrying water down there to their farmlands, they've fulfilled Isaiah 35, the desert blossoming like a rose. Well, they haven't really, but the time's coming when all of that land that's still a lot desert's going to blossom like a rose. It'll blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. In other words, happiness back there again, not fear of Arabs all around them, not a threat of world destruction, not being right in the hotbed of world politics in the Middle East, but they're going to dwell there with joy and singing, festive, happy Sabbaths and happy holidays, holy days. The glory of Lebanon is going to be given to the desert. So places that used to be desolate and barren and empty are going to end up forested, being given the glory of Lebanon, cedars of Lebanon planted and growing all over them. The excellency of Carmel and Sharon, those are the richest farming areas of Judah. They're going to see the glory of the eternal. Here, once again, not just that they're going to see him as a glorified being, but they're going to see the glory of his work, of his, the fruit of his kingdom, the excellency of our God. Strengthen you the weak hands, Confirm the feeble knees. Say to those of the fearful heart, be strong, don't be afraid. Behold, your God will come. So here's if people, when things are really getting bad, right before all the brightness of the new world comes, people's knees are going to become weak with all the horrors and troubles and problems and complications. So we're going to have to do what he says here in verse 3 for one another and for the peoples in the world in general. Tell them there's hope. Tell them there's good news about the world tomorrow. Tell them about the wonderful world tomorrow. Strengthen you the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees by saying to them, be strong, don't be afraid, your God's going to come. Remember, God's promised to intervene. Christ has promised to come back. Remember the Feast of Trumpets. Remember the Feast of Tabernacles. Remember the Sabbath. Say to those of a fearful heart. So we know ahead of time, people are going to become weak-kneed, weak-handed and feeble-kneed and faint-hearted. He's going to come and save you. And when Christ comes back to save the people of Israel, right at the darkest time of their history, then the eyes of the blind are going to be opened. Now you can take this spiritually or literally either way, because it's true both ways. People's eyes are going to be opened spiritually to the truth. Their ears are going to have ears that hear, and they're going to be able to understand. Then the lame is going to leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb is going to sing. Because in the wilderness, waters are going to break out. So Christ comes back, steps on the mountain, and it breaks open, and waters start flowing out of there all over Palestine, back down to the Suez again. In the wilderness, waters will break out, and streams in the desert. Then the parched ground is going to become a pool, and thirsty land is going to end up having springs of water. So you found out in West Texas and Kansas, underground rivers that were just waiting there ready to be tapped and drawn out, and now land that used to be desolate is being farmed with irrigation. But this way God is going to do this supernaturally. The parched ground, the pool, the thirsty land, springs of waters, in the habitation of these wild animals in the wildernesses where each lay grass and reeds and rushes, and a highway shall be there and a way, and it'll be called the Holy Road, as one translation translates it, the way of holiness. So that's not just symbolical of God's way being the only road, the only highway, the right way, but it's literal. There'll be a safe, happy, joyous, protected highway. The unclean won't pass over it. In other words, no one that's going to make war or try to take somebody else's properties, no unredeemed, are going to attack it or come by it. The wayfaring men, no fools, are not going to err therein. No lion is going to be there. No ravenous beast is going to go up thereon. Now you can take that literally or symbolically. No human empires like lions, no human governments like ravenous beasts are going to devour God's highway. That God's way is going to be enforced on the whole earth, and none of these ravenous beasts of human governments are going to be allowed there. Thereon it'll not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. Now it looks like when you see terms like salvation, he will save you, the redeemed, that you'd recognize he's talking here about spiritual redemption and salvation, and not just brought back out of the physical captivity. And the ransomed, another word that shows that, the ransomed of the eternal are going to return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy on their heads. They'll obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So almost the whole chapter is a millennial chapter. Now in chapter 36, he begins a group of three chapters that deal with the physical happenings of that day when the Assyrians came down and harassed Hezekiah. So our main interest is looking into prophecy, so we'll just scan through these rather quickly. And it came to pass in King Hezekiah's 14th year, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. and the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish, which was one of the key fortresses of Israel, right on the main road between there and Egypt. So that's naturally where he would first come. So he sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a great army. So he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field, and then came forth to him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son, which is over the house. Of course, we read a prophecy a little earlier about him being put in that position back in chapter 22, if you want to jot down a marginal reference. Maybe we ought to turn back there and remind ourselves of that. Verse 20, Isaiah 22:20, God said, "It's going to come to pass in that day, I'll call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, clothe him with your robe, strengthen him with your girdle, commit your government into his hand. He'll be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and of the house of Judah. The key of the house of David I'll give upon his shoulder." So he was a type of the Christ later. "So he'll open and unshut, and shut and unopen. I'll fasten him as a nail in a sure place. He'll be for a glorious throne to his father's house. They'll hang upon him all the glory of his father's house, the offspring, the issue, all the vessels of small quantity. In that day, says the Eternal Host, the nail that's fastened in the sure place shall be removed and cut down and fall, and the burden that was upon it will be cut off." So that's some 10 years earlier, and now you find at this time God did what he said he'd do, and Eliakim is put in this prominent position. Then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son, which was over the house, just like God had said he would, and then Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, Asaph's son, the recorder. So Rabshakeh said to them, and here you begin a speech of a heathen king, so he gets a little foul in his language in a couple of places, and God chose to just go ahead and let it be put in the record. So, he used some pretty rough language here in one verse at least. "Now you say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king." Now, of course, that's taking one of God's titles. If you remember back in one of the Psalms, the great king, that's really God's name. But he doesn't pay too much attention to that. "Thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein you trust? I say you, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Lo, you trust in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it'll go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all the trust in him. But if you say to me, we trust in the eternal our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away?" Now, of course, Hezekiah hadn't taken away God's altars. He tore away the ones that the peoples had followed Israel and set up all kinds of high places and altars in every place they chose. And he brought them back to the one altar back at Jerusalem. So he's trying to split the people here by this trickery, saying, remember all those places you used to get to go to worship? And now Hezekiah's made it hard for you. He says you all have to go to one place. Why, look, he's the one that removed all these high places and altars. Weren't those to the real God? Well, they weren't really. They tried to claim they were, but they weren't. Didn't Hezekiah say to Judah and Jerusalem, you'll worship before this altar right here in Jerusalem? Now therefore, come out and give hostages and pledges and tribute, I pray you, to my master, the king of Assyria. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. You can't even come up with 3,000 riders or 2,000 riders. They're qualified to ride these horses in the cavalry. So how are you going to turn away the face of one captain? And here the Hebrew word is really the word for governor. So it shows again the Assyrian army was a conglomerate of several kings and several governors and several nationalities. And the word is a governor of a province here. So he's saying, how are you going to turn away the face of even one of the governors of one of the provinces, of the least of my master's servants? You couldn't even do battle with one of the least of our allies. And here you're going to try to thwart all of us. And you put your trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen. And am I now come up without the eternal against this land to destroy it? Why, hadn't you been told a decade ago that the king of Assyria was going to come down and you should give yourself into his hands and it'd go well with you? So apparently he'd been aware of their prophecy in Judea about their success coming down anyway. But that was against the northern tribes and not against the whole family of Israel. So he told a half-truth and half-lie. Am I now come up without the Eternal against this land to destroy it? Why, the Eternal said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Of course, that's a lie. It wasn't true. God did tell him to go up against Israel. And he told them they better not rely on Egypt. They better give themselves into the hands. But they wouldn't do it. Then Eliakim said, and Shebna and Joab to Rabshakeh, look, why do you have to tell everybody all this? Why speak in a language that everybody knows? Speak, I pray you, to your servants in the Aramean, which is the international language of commerce that the leaders all knew. We understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew. Now, they're saying, not wanting all the people to hear everything that's being said because they were afraid the people would get frightened and get worried and lose faith. And so the leaders just said, well, why don't you just speak in the language that we leaders understand and don't trouble all the common people with it? Well, Rabshakeh said, my master hadn't sent me, just to your master and to you, to speak these words. This is going to happen to every one of you. All of the people trying to defend your